Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast, the MERS political newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rurink, Jack Spencer, and our special guest for the week is Mackenzie Frost from Sinclair Broadcasting. Outgoing from Sinclair Broadcasting. Mackenzie, it's great to have you on the podcast, but looks like this may be the last one for a while from you.
Yes, unfortunately, it's been fun, Kyle, but a little bittersweet that I'm moving on, but, greener pastures in Baltimore, hopefully.
Well, if I remember right, though, Detroit is a bigger media market than Baltimore, so who knows? Maybe in 2 or 3 years, something in Detroit will pop up and we'll get to see you again. That's what I'm banking on.
It's you and my mom both.
All right, guys. Well, let's talk about one of the bigger issues going on right now from over the weekend. Senator Tom Barrett from Potterville, Republican, testing positive for COVID-19. And, John, I think the question that the state senator's got to be asking is, does this mean we got to get tested? I mean, let's look at this. Tom Barrett was in two Senate committees on Thursday. He was with probably about a dozen senators in both of those committee meetings who then went on to other committee meetings. And if we do kind of the contact tracing here, I counted about 20 senators that could possibly have been exposed, maybe?
Well, yeah. And think about this, too. His test was on the 31st, right, of July. We don't know where he was in terms of the disease itself. So there was a Senate session, a prolonged Senate session, where the entire Senate was there, 22nd and the 23rd. So the question is, was he transmitting or was he contagious at that point? And if so, how many people then does that impact? We also talked, I think, earlier today about he had an event for Unlock Michigan, where 500 people drove through to sign the Unlock Michigan petition. What was his role there? Was he at the window of these cars? How did that work? Was he contagious then? So there's lots of different ripples here that can be extrapolated out.
July 18 was the date of the Unlock Michigan event, and obviously tested on July 31st. He tested on the 31st because he's part of the Michigan National Guard, and they required that he be tested. So it was not because he was feeling sick. It was just because he had to be tested, and this is what happened. The ripple effects of this, Mackenzie, could be pretty significant.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is what we're dealing with in a lot of different workplaces across the state and across the country. People have that same issues. But like you said, we have to think about all of the people that he was in contact with, and then those people were in contact with, and then they go back to their districts. And it's the same situation that we've been talking about for months of where were they in this? And then now, you know, as a lawmaker, are you sitting there thinking, do I need to get tested? Should I get tested? Should my family get tested? What do we do? And have we heard any directives from anybody, Kyle? I don't know.
Well, again, we'll just have to watch and see what happens. Can you test that quickly to find out that nobody else has it? Because you minus one member is not necessarily going to stop them. But I just don't know if you can even test that quickly.
Yeah, I think we're getting tests every 2 days? Mackenzie, you got tested. What was the timeline like?
My timeline was pretty quick. It was like 17 hours later I got my results. But I also know that I've heard from a lot of people recently that the test results are taking longer and longer and longer. We're getting some coworkers and everything, you know, friends and family are getting tested, and they're having to wait 4 or 5 days before they get the results. And if that's the case, then that could be an issue.
So it looks like the House and the Senate are both canceling session and canceling any type of committee meeting. The meet and greet with whoever won the primaries on Tuesday has been canceled. Everything's been canceled right now. And this really puts Republicans in a little bit of a problem because they had hoped to get out this education package that they had been pushing, the kind of the alternative to what schools should be dealing with, heavy on standardized testing and letting schools decide what they want to do. But that's going to be put off at least a week because the Senate is and the House are not going to be in. And you also have to wonder, how is this going to impact the collection of signatures now for Unlock Michigan? Because the whole point of this is that Governor Whitmer is making decisions unilaterally, that she is doing it without legislative approval or legislative input at the very least. Well, if this were to be successful, theoretically, what happens then if the governor has to reissue an emergency declaration and she needs legislative consent? Well, if the legislature can't meet because it's a safety hazard for them to meet together to approve of emergency declaration, then do we fall out of emergency declaration? And does that cause its own problems? So there's a lot of different layers here that create some problems just down the line here for lawmakers, other than just the simple fact one member has COVID-19. Well, meanwhile, as this has been playing out, the legislature did receive word back from the governor's office that she had indeed vetoed the Pete Lucido bill dealing with nursing homes. And I mentioned the nursing home story because the Republicans have really latched on to the story about nursing homes and the governor's decision early to put COVID-19 positive people into nursing homes. Now, since the last 2 months or so, we have seen the death toll go down significantly, which would seem to indicate that maybe the governor's office and DHHS have taken proper precautions when it comes to the nursing homes, that maybe the initial decision was not maybe the best decision, but they've taken proper precautions. And I bring this up, John, because I wonder if it's time for Republicans to switch their messaging on what they want to do. Is this nursing home thing run its course? And is it time to start thinking about or start talking about those businesses that are kind of stuck in neutral and what happens to them? I'm talking about movie theaters, live entertainment, gyms, these other places where people can gather and have gathered and can gather, but they haven't been able to gather because of the executive orders. And I bring this up because I was sitting in church and I was taking a look at how people have been socially distanced in church. Pews have been roped off and, you got hand sanitizer meeting me when I walk in. And could the same thing be done for some of these other industries? And at some point, does the governor have to consider giving these a go? Because let's face it, I mean, this thing isn't going to get any different in September or October or November. And what's going to happen to these businesses?
Well, I think at some point she does have to do that. And I think she probably is starting to. It was interesting. I think the New York Times today had a speculative piece that they're estimating as many as one third of small businesses in the city of New York itself are going to close because of the pandemic. You can open some of these businesses up. She's done that a little bit with the casino order, although she limited the casino operations to, I think, 15% of their capacity, which is what the gaming board recommended. But still, you got to start slowly opening up stuff, but you got to be very careful too at the same time.
Yeah, Jack, I wanted to get your thoughts on this because so she opens up casinos, and how much more dangerous or much more safe is going into a casino than going into, I don't know, a gymnastic studio, for example, or going bowling? How big of a difference is it?
I don't know what the difference is. There may be some differences that we don't immediately realize if you take a deeper look at it. In a gymnasium, are you coming to more physical contact for various reasons? Are you running around doing physical things that may bring you in more contact? Is it harder to socially distance if somebody falls with a thud and on a mat and has to have help? I don't know. I just don't think there's any way you can do it without being criticized. And I don't think there's any way you can do it where you can justify it in a quick enough explanation to satisfy the people who are criticizing you. I just don't think it's very good politically. Ultimately, people are going to put up with it for a while, but at a certain point, I think there is a political cost to pay if the governor continues to have to do it for weeks and months going forward.
Because unlike some industries, I mean, you could argue that, you know, there are safety precautions here that she obviously has to take into account. But if you're allowing people into certain gatherings and you can take certain precautions, it does get kind of problematic to continue to have to justify this, Mackenzie. If we can go into church and we can separate, then why can't we go into a theater? Why can't we go into, I don't know, let's say an outdoor ballpark or an outdoor stadium? I mean, football season's coming here pretty soon. I mean, will they be allowed to have 200 people in there, 250 or what have you? It would seem like there's got to be some trust that has to be put into the public to do certain things, because maybe they'll just do them anyway.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, going back to just the different industries really quickly, because I've gotten a lot of emails and Facebook messages from friends in the skating community who are wondering, why aren't ice rinks open? When can ice rinks be open? You know, and I think that everyone could agree that, you know, perhaps hockey might not be the best option right now with checking and whatnot and all that equipment. But for skating, figure skating, that's an isolated, socially distanced sport to begin with. There's a lot that people could do there too. And there's just a lot of wondering, how come this industry but not this one? And what do you do? And the level of trust there, I think, is something that needs to be tested, because nobody wants to see this continue any longer than it has to. And at some point, people will either do it or they won't. And we're not going to know if they're going to do it until we test it out.
Now, you say that ice skating is socially distancing, but if you're not very good at ice skating, see, you're good at it, but if you're not very good and you're having to grab the boards and, like, keep your hands on the boards and falling on your face.
Maybe not public skate, Kyle. Keep your skates to yourself at home for a while. But lessons could be, you know, you could do that from a distance.
All right. The other subject I wanted to talk about, John, is the sheriffs who aren't enforcing the executive orders. What is preventing people in these communities from not complying with wearing a mask or other executive orders if these sheriffs are picking and choosing which executive orders they want to follow? And do they run into any political risks by being difficult with complying or enforcing orders?
What's going to enforce the orders is the business community is going to have to follow suit, because it's the business community that's going to wind up losing their licenses or losing their ability to operate if they don't enforce the mask themselves. I would hope, regardless of what the sheriffs say, if a physical dispute arises in a store over the mask mandate that store owners are required to follow, that they would still do their job and keep the peace. If they don't, that's where I suspect sheriffs would run into political problems and blowback.
Jack, what's your thoughts on the sheriffs and what they're doing right now? I mean, I guess you could argue that where these communities are, the sheriffs are probably politically popular doing what they're doing.
I've looked at the first 6 months. The number of people in Michigan that died of heart disease dwarfs the number of people that died of COVID-19. I think they have a right to understand the risks. On the other hand, I also am not somebody who argues for not having the mask, because even if they weren't necessary, and I'm not going to say they aren't, but there's half the people in the store that are terrified. How about just the common decency to know there are people afraid of it?
Mackenzie, I wanted you to weigh in on this, because you've got reporters across the state with Sinclair Broadcasting. What are you picking up as far as people's compliance with these executive orders and how they're feeling about where their sheriffs are on this?
You know, I think the majority of people, if it's required, they'll do it. They'll probably complain about it, but they'll wear a mask if they have to. But I've seen sheriffs and, you know, law enforcement agencies across the state who say that they're not doing it anymore. They're not going to enforce it because they have other things to worry about. And if they're not enforcing it, I feel like then that's just kind of undermining the order, because people know, and especially when sheriffs make a big deal about it and they like post publicly that they're not going to enforce it, and people know that, and they know that there won't be any repercussions for them.
I thought this would take care of itself, because I thought the minute the business had an interest in it, that is when they'd really be cracking down on it. Businesses can always say, you know, no shirt, no shoes, no service, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, I heard a story from a family member in the Flint area who was upset that the store wasn't mandating masks. So they went to the store owner, and the store owner said that they weren't going to do it. So they went to the sheriff's department about it, and the sheriff said, absolutely not. The order is unconstitutional. And I think that boils down to, that boils the issue down where, yes, people are under the impression that it's law and that they're supposed to do it, but then you have law enforcement agencies who are on the side of this lawsuit that we're seeing play out and say, this is an unconstitutional order to begin with, and I'm not going to enforce it because I don't believe in it. And it's kind of mixing personal beliefs with their public duty.
I don't know. That sounds a little dangerous, John, when we've got police officers who are deciding to determine what they think is law and what's not. Maybe we need the Supreme Court to step up and settle that lawsuit quickly. They didn't do it by their August 1 break, but I guess you're not required to because it wasn't part of the regular caseload. But it seems like they better get this thing settled sooner than later.
It certainly sounds like that. And I'm not sure if I were an elected sheriff and if I had a deputy make that kind of statement and judgment on his own, that deputy would be employed very much longer under my regime. But that's just my perspective. The law is the law, and let the attorneys and the courts decide what the law is. We don't need deputies deciding what the law is.
You know, I agree with that. I also wanted to comment, because I experienced this, and I actually did resent the people not wearing the masks.
Let's change the subject here. Waiting patiently here on our Zoom call, Eric Lufer from the Citizens Research Council. Thanks for sticking with us here, and I hope we didn't bore you too much with the intro there.
No, it's fascinating conversation, and I happen to be reading a biography of Ulysses S. Grant. They're dealing with some of the same issues, things that they felt were unconstitutional at the time, but who was it to decide? And he took a very narrow perspective that he's not a judge, so until somebody says he can't do it, that's the law of the land. And here we are again dealing with the same sorts of issues.
The more things change, the more they stay the same, I guess, eh?
Yes, which brings us to a horrible budget.
Oh, my goodness gracious. So just for our listeners' perspective, what we're facing right now is really pretty historic, Eric, and that's not using hyperbole. I mean, what we're dealing with here is much different.
It is very much different. And typically when you enter a recession, it's sort of a slow, shallow slope that takes you into a downfall, and you sort of know things are bad, but it's the economists tell you in retrospective that a recession started several months ago, and you feel it. And this time around, the door slammed shut, and here we were with the economy shut off and people not moving, people not buying things, not working, so therefore not earning income that the state would levy a tax on. So it's just an all of a sudden recession. At the time, you know, a couple months ago when they had the consensus revenue estimating conference, the best economists in the state sort of, they didn't characterize it as a V-shaped recession where you go down and back up again, but that's what it looked like to me. But they were looking at all the public health studies that said, you know, we're going to narrow the curve and it's going to go away and we'll have just a few cases that are manageable with tracing and things. But that hasn't played out. This continues to go on and on. So that V-shaped recession is going to have a much bigger bottom to it. Things are getting better, but not in any way that's going to fix our budget anytime soon.
Eric, I think you and I talked about this way back in April. It's kind of become a little bit more real now with the numbers that are out. Could the state borrow funds to sort of get through to the end of this pandemic, assuming we're going to have a vaccine? The news sounds pretty positive on that front.
It is possible, but the mechanics work out to make it very, very difficult. We have just seen the state prior to the pandemic, the governor couldn't get the money to fix the damn roads, so she was going to sell bonds based on the revenue projections of gasoline and vehicle registration fees, and it didn't require a vote of the people because you were just pledging against future revenues. But what we would be talking about in the case of the scenario you lay out is a general obligation bond that requires a vote of the people. So you think about sort of the timing of the whole thing. We are now 2 months away from the beginning of the state fiscal year. You got to come up with something soon. We're waiting on Washington, D.C., our beloved friends in the national capital to figure out what they're going to do. Going to have to do something soon so you can get the budget in place for October 1st. A vote of the people at the earliest couldn't occur until the general election in November. So could they create a budget that has two different scenarios, one with borrowing and one without? It's possible, again, unprecedented, but we live in unprecedented times. And then, you know, you have to go through the whole thing of canvassing the vote. We know that's going to be slow this time. So they might not even have an answer for that until December or late in December. It's very difficult. They could do it. I wouldn't discount it. It would be very difficult just because of the timing and the requirement to get a vote of the people.
So their opportunity to have borrowed occurred earlier this spring, and it's since passed. If we had wanted to put it in front of the people, August would have been the time to do it.
August would have been the time to do it. The Constitution calls for those votes to be held at general elections, which are the November gubernatorial or presidential elections. We've seen past legislatures move that to different times. So it's possible that, but yeah, but they're playing the waiting game, right? They're trying to see if there's the men in the white hats coming from D.C. to dump a bucket of money at the state's feet and get through this. And it's a dangerous game to play.
Now, my impression has been that there's a tremendous amount of kind of demand for in a lot of areas. And it's kind of like a very uneven plane. Part of the economy just completely shut down, but other areas with all the demand. Is that normal for a recession, or is that unusual?
Yeah, with a recession, typically those at the lower and middle incomes are hit much harder than the higher levels of income. And we see that playing out again this time. We have the essential workers, which are those that are able to work through this whole thing. Getting by, they had some period of enhanced payment. All the while, the white-collar workers were either working from home or doing what they could be doing because they have the ability to work remotely. So the white-collar workers, I think, is where that pent-up demand is, that they're not going on vacations, they're not spending money, making big ticket purchases, things like that. So there's a lot more savings going on with people savings as opposed to business or government. A lot less disposable income being spent at those higher amounts. At the same time, we know that unemployment is at historic levels. We know that even those essential workers are just making enough to, many of them, just making enough to get by and don't have enough to really have disposable income. So it really is a story of the haves and the have-nots, and that is a story that you tell with a lot of recessions.
I mean, we're banking on this having an end, right? A vaccine or whatnot. And what happens, what's the long-term impacts of this? Like, when we know we have the budget problem for this upcoming year, but then next year, what are we looking at, and how much does the state need to really dig itself out of this hole? And then I think the question we've been hearing mostly is just, what happens if the feds don't come through with more help? What does the state do?
The answer to your last question is pretty simple, that they have two options: make major cuts or come up with new revenue resources. And common sense tells you that increasing taxes in the middle of a recession is not the best time to do that, either politically or because it just doesn't raise that much revenue to begin with. We, the Citizens Research Council, have spent a lot of time over the last couple of years documenting how our tax structure has not kept pace with the economy, and we're taxing less and less. So in the long term, that is a solution we're going to have to look at. But in the middle of a recession, not the best place to do it. So without help from the federal government, it's going to be a lot of cuts. We're talking about $3 billion in projected shortfall, and that was from a few months ago when they were looking at it. And as I said, what they projected with this playing out isn't what we're seeing. So they missed the mark a little bit. You know, what's the long-term consequence? I think we're going to have to get through this. And that was the beauty of the idea. Could we borrow to get through it? If we thought we were at par before, we're going to go below it and get back to par eventually. How do you survive through that without the ability to borrow, without help coming from Washington? There's the real danger that those cuts of that magnitude could do long-term or medium-term instead of just the short-term, do medium-term damage to the state budget and therefore everyone that depends on the state budget. For the state does very little. It passes money on to universities and for healthcare and local governments to do the things they do. The state is the primary funding of our school system. So to say the state has a shortfall sounds like that entity that exists in Lansing with the fancy dome is going to hurt, but it's really a lot of entities throughout the state. 80% of all the money the state brings in goes to someone else to provide a service. And it's the damage is that there's long-term damage that you've lost the ability of others to provide services, and they won't be there when the economy gets back and we're saying, let's go back to the way it was before. That's the real potential consequence, Eric, of not getting through this.
Eric, if you didn't cut your way out of it or completely cut your way out of it, and you decided to do some revenue enhancements as a way to resolve that $2.1 billion hole, what would the economic impacts be if you took this occasion to actually start taxing services? Would it further the recession or deepen the recession? What do you think?
You're putting me out on a branch a little bit here for others to take shots at. The beauty of a sales tax is that people feel it in bits and pieces, right? With your property tax, you get a bill, you pay twice a year. The bigger the bill, the more the pain. With the sales tax, you notice it a little bit at a time. Your dollar purchase turns into $1.06. So to have that put on services, now some things that you have been paying for, you're just going to pay a little bit more at a time. So I don't think it would necessarily slow down an economic recovery. It's more the politics of it than the economics of it. And we saw back in the Granholm administration how horrible the politics can be if you don't do it right.
What would a sales tax on services generate if you apply the same $0.06?
Well, the question there is what services to include. A lot of services are health related. Do you really want to have people with health problems pay more for the services they need? There's some education type things. It is potential enough that it could grow the sales tax by another 50% or so. We are leaving a lot of money on the table by not taxing services, and services that many other states do tax. So we wouldn't be out on the limb, unique in what we do. We're sort of behind in the things we do. The difficulty is determining what services to be included in the tax base. We said this, had the story back in the Granholm administration that the easiest one to do was the barbershops, and the hardest one to do was the barbershops, because now you have people sitting around talking to each other, griping about the new tax they have. So it's that sort of dynamic on, you can find all kinds of services that could be included and how that plays out. The other part of it I should mention, you want to be careful to avoid the compounding of the tax, because a lot of services are done in the business sector to provide a service to a business to ultimately provide an end product. So do you want to tax the legal service that somebody, that a business has, that is, is part of what they do? So do they bring that legal service in-house then? And it changes the whole dynamics in the escalation of product development because of some of those things. So it can and should be done. Be careful where you tread, though.
Well, let's talk about what $3 billion in cuts looks like, Eric. I'm just kind of spitballing here, but I mean, you could start with the $600 million that we put from the general fund into transportation. And let's say that you use the governor's idea to bond for additional money for roads and maybe do more of a one-for-one, or maybe, a little bit more lopsided, but you take that off the table. You take $600 million away from the general fund, and you use that to fill the hole. I mean, there's a start. You can do that. We've still got $800 million left in the rainy day fund, so that gets us to 1.4. Let's say that you eliminate statutory revenue sharing. The cities ain't going to like that, but let's say that that's something you could do. What's that? I don't know if that's $1 billion.
That's 250 million dollars.
All right. So that gets us a little closer. Then what about universities? Let's say we cut what we give universities in half. What does that get you?
In 2019, I went back and looked, they got $1.2 billion, so cutting them in half. And there's the hope. They got some money out of the CARES Act. They certainly hope that they're going to get more money out of anything that comes out of D.C. That, you know, that was the beauty of what we just went through with the supplemental, is they tried to do swap state dollars for federal dollars. And I would assume they're going to try to do that again in this next round of balancing the next budget.
So that gets us up to $2.25 billion. We're going to have to do some cuts to the school aid fund, I imagine. And we're going to have to do some cuts to health and human services. And maybe that gets us to where we got to get.
Health and human services is the biggest part of the general fund budget at $4.7 billion. But at the same time, the population of people being served is growing, with more people out of work, requiring Medicaid and other health services to get by. So at the time that there's greater demand, it's a hard time to cut that part of the budget. The difficulty of it is that while we have a state budget that's $59-60 billion, you think, well, you can find $3 billion, but when you start piecing that apart, only $34 billion comes from state resources. The other is federal funding, and that's tied up. Most of that, about $15 billion of the state resources, is school aid funding or highway funding, natural resources, things like that. So that's pretty much tied up. You don't have much discretion to cut that to balance your budget. It leaves about $10 billion in the general fund budget, and almost half of that is money that state has to spend to draw down federal funding. So yeah, you can cut here and there. That $600 million they were going to spend for roads certainly is the top of the list of candidates. But when you start going through the rest of the state budget, the State Department, Treasury, DTMB, LEO, the legislative and executive budgets, they just don't amount to much. So even doing a 30, 40, 50% cut in those budgets just doesn't get you very far in getting to $3 billion. It's going to be very painful if the state has to do this on its own. And it's likely money coming from the federal government, at least what I'm hearing right now. I think it's likely that it's going to be dedicated to schools and trying to get kids back in schools in a safe way, providing the schools with the PPE they need. That's about a third of this 3.1. It's the other $2 billion that's going to have to come out of this general fund, and that's not going to be easy.
All right, Eric Lufer with the Citizens Research Council. Kind of some doom and gloom here for the middle of the podcast, but unfortunately, that's the situation if we don't get federal money. Thanks.
I want to come back when there's a good story to tell.
All right, joining us now with Zoom, an old friend of MERS, Simon Schuster with the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Simon, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Kyle. It's great to be back. It's been a little while.
It has been. It's been too long, but we're glad to have you. And I wanted to have you on because we had some very interesting stories going on over the past week with the various campaign contributions, and you did a special report that I kind of wanted to highlight here to kick things off on how COVID-19 has impacted campaign contributions. What did you find on that?
So obviously Lansing as a political community has a strong fundraising culture. You know, for a lot of legislators that are in office right now, a lot of the flows from institutional funders, sort of special interest groups that try to make their voice heard in Lansing, a lot of that's built on face-to-face interaction, right? What I found is that when the stay-at-home order was enacted in that period from the end of March to the beginning of June, that fundraising essentially flatlined for that period. And so it caused an enormous dip in funding. And I looked at weekly donation totals for every House candidate and found that compared to 2016 and this year, that donation was less in the total donations were less than half of what they had been in the last presidential election year.
So basically people stopped giving. Is that what you're saying?
Not everyone, PACs certainly essentially cratered their fundraising, but individuals, both at the grassroots level and at larger donors, essentially continued to give after an initial slowdown where, you know, there was sort of that few weeks at the beginning of the stay at home order where we were like, this is the apocalypse. You couldn't find toilet paper. At that point, you know, there wasn't a lot of donations. But as the stay at home order progressed, things started to feel a little bit more normal. You could see that individual donors, especially larger individual donors, continued to give and even kind of made up for lost ground.
There was a temporary dip, but eventually money found its way to where it's got to go. Money's always kind of like water when it comes to these campaigns.
Yes, that's very true. And we found also that, you know, after the stay-at-home order ended, that essentially everything became surging back, and there was a huge increase in fundraising, not from individuals, but from PACs. And so essentially the total expense of all these house races, when you look at all the districts, is essentially on pace for what it was back in 2016. A little bit lower, but not significant.
Mackenzie?
I just think it's fascinating. I just think people staying at home, that would, to me, that would be like the last thing people would be thinking about is campaign fundraising and things like that. But to see that we're, you know, now we're back to where we were, I just think it's fascinating and just goes to show that there's some things just don't stop even when the rest of the world does.
I wondered if you had a chance to look. I know you said PACs did start to come back once the order was lifted, right? Specifically, I wonder what the business community PACs are doing vis-a-vis what they did 4 years ago. I read recently that I think the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is spending a fraction this year of what it did, and it seems like the business community is kind of playing a little bit of hands off this presidential election year. So I wonder if that reflected anywhere here in Michigan on the state level.
It would be really interesting to find out. I mean, I have found that some of the largest PACs are sort of declined from their previous spending totals, at least in regards to special interests. But when you look at the wealthiest families in Michigan, the DeVos family, they're still contributing as though they always have.
Speaking about large PACs, talk about Lee Chatfield and what he's been able to do with his four PACs, Simon.
Yeah, Lee Chatfield as a leadership PAC is unprecedented, both in his contributions and spending. If you looked at him beyond basically all, compared to all PACs. Yeah, so Chatfield is then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It's the seventh highest. He spent the seventh most money of any PAC in the state of Michigan.
And for a leadership PAC, that's just unbelievable. So you got the four caucus PACs, and then who do you got after that?
Yeah, well, so actually the highest spending one is the Michigan Republican Party, and then before that is Gretchen Whitmer for governor. You have a ballot committee below that, Fair and Equal Michigan, and then the Michigan House Democratic Fund, who's actually outspent its Republican counterpart. But even the Senate Republican Campaign Committee has spent almost as much as the House Democratic Fund. Below that, you have BCBS and then Chatfield's Majority Fund.
Yeah.
So it's outspent some of the caucus PACs.
What's the difference between Blue Cross and Chatfield's Majority Fund?
BCBS has spent about $849,000 as opposed to $807,000 for the Chatfield Majority Funds.
He's right there.
Yeah. He's not even far off.
And he's sitting on a lot of campaign cash, too. So this is, you know, this is expenditures to date from the beginning of 2019. So he has, you know, a considerable wallet here to make contributions as the campaign moves forward. And I think it's important to note that because he has multiple leadership PACs, that he can exceed even the $10,000 limit.
So would I be interpreting this correctly to say that this year in the fall, both sides can accuse the other one of being backed mostly by fat cats?
Yes. And I think that as a result, you're going to see people avoiding that kind of rhetoric.
Where are we at with the recall effort for Governor Whitmer? And we heard so much about it. And now give us an update.
So it seems that the recall effort is essentially in flames, that there's going to be not potentially a full reset. Volunteers are still motivated, but it's not, at least any sort of organization is not going to be happening under the leadership of Chad Bozzie as of now, although he would tell you that that is going to happen eventually under his name. But essentially, there's been a fissure within his the recall effort that he initially led and had ballot language approved, where most of the senior leaders have basically cut all ties with Chad under allegations that he had used committee funds for personal use.
So you've taken a little look into this then. So basically it's Chad Bozzie against everybody else.
Yeah, that's correct. Most of the other organizers, or rather the person who's acting as his informal campaign manager, David Blair, has severed ties with him and now alleges that he was taking money fundraised for the committee and using it essentially at a casino to gamble with, which is a very titillating allegation.
Well, wait a minute now. So there was money raised to recall Whitmer, and this guy is claiming that Chad Bozzi used that money and gambled with it.
Yes, that's correct. Although he doesn't have any evidence to substantiate it, he did provide me with both text messages where Bozzi acknowledges that the money's missing, and he also acknowledged to me that the money's missing, and then also transaction records showing that the money had been withdrawn to a savings bank account that he has not reported as being linked to the committee yet with the Secretary of State. He has not yet filed a campaign finance statement for the last quarter, so it's really difficult to know exactly how much money they've raised and where it has gone. He claimed to me in an interview that he had an ex-girlfriend of his named Becca had taken the money and run with it, about $1,600 to $1,900. And he claimed that he doesn't know her last name and did not file a police report because it was his responsibility and intends to make up the cash.
Wait a minute. He's claiming a girlfriend stole campaign money, like he just is leaving it around the house or something?
Stacks of cash?
He claimed that these dollars were in cash and were fundraised at a 4th of July event.
So what do we expect now? I announced the recall to recall the person doing the recall?
Well, that would be quite the situation. However, my understanding is that David Blair is working now or has volunteering with another organization that has also had a ballot language approved to recall Whitmer. And Bozzi, for his part, is now alleging to me that he is going to be starting a recall campaign that will circulate petitions to recall Whitmer, Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist, Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, and Attorney General Dana Nessel in one fell swoop. As to whether that's actually going to happen, we have yet to see.
How much money was with this recall campaign? What did this Blair guy tell you? How much money had they actually raised?
So Blair told me that they had raised between $10,000 and $12,000 in total, which, I mean, a lot of us know that that is far below the amount needed to generally run a successful ballot committee, get the petitions necessary for something like this to appear on the ballot, in absence of an army of unpaid volunteers willing to circulate petitions and get those signatures. One of the other confrontations that these two men have had is over a 7,000 member Facebook group and Facebook page, which Blair has retained ownership of, and Bozzi maintains that he should be in his possession.
Wow. There are so many layers to this story.
Yeah, it's almost like a soap opera.
It is a soap opera. That's exactly what I was going to say.
Jeez.
Yes. To add another layer of complication to this tale, another campaign finance complaint has been filed with the Secretary of State from a woman named, and I hope I'm pronouncing this correct, Heather Druin, who alleges, one, that they violated the Michigan Campaign Finance Act, one, by using a bank not named in Michigan because they had a PayPal account essentially as the source of where all the donations went, and two, that they were not listing their paid for by the Committee to Recall Gretchen Whitmer on their merchandise.
Well, wait a minute. I thought he said he was dealing in cash. Now we're dealing with PayPal.
Yes, and so both Blair and Bozzi had access to this PayPal account, and now Bozzi is alleging that he can't file his quarterly campaign finance statement because Blair does not have is not providing him with the documentation needed to do so.
This is messy. This is as messy as the ex-girlfriend stealing the cash.
I think that this provides a really good example for why a lot of more professionalized ballot committees often hire an attorney for this stuff.
Not to mix the two proposals, but have you learned anything about the funding source for this Unlock Michigan?
Yeah, so the Michigans for Fiscal Responsibility is a dark money organization with deep roots in Michigan politics. However, we haven't been able to uncover the sources of their funding yet.
But this has been around for a while, though. This particular group has been used, I think, for other proposals or other issues, and now it's just kind of reemerged, right?
Yes, this is an example of how these organizations, these dark money organizations, are able to essentially act as a front group and sort of like a Swiss Army knife for a political consultant who wants, because, I mean, the entity still exists and they can be used for different purposes without having to go through the filings and setting up other nonprofits and taking the trouble to do that. Essentially, it's you make a vague enough name and it can be supporting whatever you like.
Will there be at any point, any time when we will see who actually put money into Unlock Michigan? Will they have to file an IRS report or anything?
Eventually they should. This is a 501c4, right? This is the, I'm trying to remember now.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, so as a 501c4, they will have to make an IRS filing, but they won't have to disclose their donors. Yeah. Okay. Side note, even now, David Blair is blowing up my phone. Me out. I tried to ask him what the new ballot committee is that he's partnering with, and he won't tell me.
I
don't know, there's two different ones, and he just won't tell me which one.
Goodness gracious. All right. Well, Simon, let's tie a bow on this conversation. Thank you so much for the time. Simon Schuster from the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Kyle.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks again to Simon, Eric Lufer for joining us, and of course, AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. And a goodbye here to Mackenzie Frost. And, you know, Mackenzie, I hate to say this, but Baltimore is not one of my favorite cities. My only experience with Baltimore is back in 2004, I went on vacation with the family to North Carolina, the Outer Banks. And on the way home, driving from North Carolina back to Michigan, I thought, wouldn't it be great to just see Camden Yards, where the Baltimore Orioles play? And so I got this bright idea that if I woke up super early, I could drive from the Outer Banks to Baltimore. And I made it, but in the fifth inning. And so the fifth inning around Baltimore, all the places where you would park for a ball game were already closed. So there was absolutely nowhere to park. So I found this neighborhood, and this neighborhood had signs that said, don't park for game day and whatever. Well, by this time, I'd already been cruising around Baltimore for about a half an hour, and the game was in the bottom of the fifth, and I said, screw it, I'm just going to park here. I want to go to this game.
You get towed?
No, but I did get a $150 ticket. So I was so angry that I got this $150 ticket that I fought it for a year. I went back and forth with the city of Baltimore for a year, and then I finally got a trial date. So I took a day off work from MERS, and I drove to Baltimore to fight this parking ticket. Do you remember this, John? Do you remember me taking the day off?
I do remember you taking the day off. I forgot, though, that it was Baltimore.
So I went to Baltimore to fight this $150 parking ticket. Maybe it wasn't $150, but it was somewhere around in there. It was an absurd amount of money for a parking ticket. And I got this judge who basically started off by saying, you know what, I'm feeling generous today. I'm going to let all you guys off. And so he proceeded. It didn't matter what you were there for. He basically let everybody off, except when he got to my case. And then he was kind of jostling whether he was going to do it or not. But then eventually he did decide to let me off. And so I was able to get the ticket wiped away for $150, and then I drove back.
How much did you spend on gas driving back and forth?
Well, that was when I had my Saturn, so that would have been a lot cheaper. And gas was cheaper then. So I don't know, maybe $50, $70, somewhere
the
in there.
The point, though, right? Not about...
It was the point. And this was before I had kids, so I had time to just blow on something stupid like that.
I've never been to Baltimore, so this will be my first time. So you've been there more than I have. So
you are telling a tale of successfully fighting City Hall in Baltimore.
Sounds great. I don't know why you hate it. Sounds wonderful.
That judge, though, really sounds like a lot of what I've heard about Baltimore from watching The Wire, so.
Oh.
I'll let you know. I'm sure I'll get my fair share of parking tickets while I'm there. Well, if my history in Lansing will repeat itself, then I'll have my fair share.
Just be aware, they're very expensive. All right. Thank you, guys. And until next week, I'm Kyle Mullen. Take care. Happy trails.